Hola, hola, this is Gabby.
This is Sophia.
And this is Sonia.
And this is Señora Power. Today we're bringing together the stories of Francisca Flores and Yolanda Garza Birdwell, two suspicious señoras. At least that's what we're calling them, as a tribute to their daring activism and brave organizing, which garnered the attention of multiple suspicious government agencies from the 1930s to the 1980s. If you were intrigued by their stories in the last two Suspicious Señora episodes, then stick around to hear us chat about their legacies, context, and what it means to be suspicious even today. Señora Francisca and Señora Yolanda both were under FBI surveillance at certain points in their lives and careers. In both cases, their possible communist affiliation was cause for concern among the agents that followed them around. Reading their files and the scholarship, and by files, I mean FBI files. Reading their FBI files and the scholarship written about them shows that both women defied expectations in different ways, making them threatening to an oppressive anti-communist government. And just like, you know, to be clear, Flores, one of our Los Angeles señoras, was surveilled from 1940s to the 1960s, about 20 years. So this is 20 years of having some rando follow you around and report on everything that you do. That's wild.
Weirdos.
Garza Birdwell, one of our Houston señoras, was surveilled around the 1950s or 1960s. Both were conscious of certain parts of this surveillance and continued their organizing, retaining their political affiliations throughout arrests, threats, and harassment. So I want to ask, you know, this is kind of just wild to think about, being surveilled all the time by one actual person looking at you. I know that we talk a lot about the surveillance state now and, you know, our devices and things like that. But having somebody like looking at you, writing about you, having people have meetings about you specifically, that's a whole different kind of thing. And so I want to look at what Flores and Birdwell's, Garza Birdwell's reactions were to surveillance, and what you guys think about it. Are there strategies of resistance in the ways that they chose to affiliate politically and organizationally? Like, you know, they were both communists at certain parts of their lives, or for all of their lives, depending. And, you know, they were part of coalitional organizations at certain parts of their lives, too, creating spaces for people to gather who are like-minded, things like that. So just to recap, you know, how were their experiences different or similar? And what kind of strategies of resistance or resilience do we see? Is their organizational affiliation part of that, or is it not?
I think this is a great question, because the first thing that came to mind as you were asking this question, Gabby, is the kind of very specific señora strategies. And I know we've mentioned like a whole bunch of them, but the main one that I'm thinking of is changing your name after you're married. Because one of the reactions that I had in both, well, I guess in Francisca Flores's archive, Yolanda doesn't really have an archive. She has a couple of scholarly articles written about her activism and about her surveillance and stuff like that. And in what we saw in Francisca's archive and what we've seen in the scholarship about Yolanda, the common thing that they both share is that they both have a whole bunch of different names that they go under. They're not aliases or anything like that. It's like their single name, their family name versus their married name. And just keeping track of all of those name changes. I mean, if it was confusing for us, I'm sure that it was probably confusing for other people in the moment. I think Yolanda acknowledges that at some point by saying, you know, they didn't even know what my name was or what to call me or what to like file me under, right? So I'm seeing a little bit of like a señora strategy there, in the sense of like, if you're already aware that you're being surveilled, you use those name changes to your advantage, right? And it reminds me also of Comisión Femenil and all of the different acronyms that it goes under, all of the different name changes in many of our señoras organizations that they participate in.
It's really clever to point to name change as a Señora strategy in reaction to surveillance. I also think that something we've been tracking across all of our Señoras is their ability to connect to different people and create networks of support. And both of these Señoras had that. Flores, for example, went literally underground. Like, they could not find her for multiple years because people were hiding her. Like, that's pretty intense. And also, you know, in talking to Señora Garza Birdwell, she talks a lot about how she has a kind of community surrounding her that protects her and is quite insular even to this day. So I think that both of them have these strategies of connecting to people in order to kind of survive this surveillance, which is both tricky and clever because the FBI is also tapping into these support networks in these communities. But I'm thinking along the lines of looking at the FBI files. For example, Señora Flores's FBI files list like over 20 different, informants, over 20 different informants that were a part of both the Communist Party, but also the Chicano movement. And all these people that were like her neighbors, for example, and we've been talking about how señoras like contact their neighbors and go door to door. So like, it's really interesting, I think, that they used people, kinship, networks, community to survive, but it's also like a tool of the FBI to use those same people against these particular señoras.
Also, thinking about the name change too, sorry, going back a little bit to the name change thing, it's an interesting, weird anecdote that, like, the FBI person following Francisco around at some point, that person did not know who Francis, who's Francis, who's she? Francis, and then her, Francisco's husband, I don't remember his name at the time, but they mixed them up. Like, they said Francis was Francisco's husband, the Francis very politically activated like fictional person. So I think that's like really funny because, again, like, you know, not an on purpose strategy, you know, to like get married. I mean, maybe we had a whole conversation in Yolanda's episode about that, but not a purposeful conversation. I mean, strategy to be like, let me change my married name, you know, all that stuff. And yet the incompetence of the surveilling people also worked in their favor in a lot of ways too, which I find hilarious and sad kind of too. But yeah, I think we come back to the idea of like community over and over again, and like the way that community protects like genuine organizers, you know, because like they genuinely have the community's best interests at heart, and that señoras are the best organizers in a way too. But yeah, I mean, I think following up on the idea of señorahood and like what does it mean to be like a woman who is creating these communities, who is being surveilled, right? Like it or not, we live in a society that like where gendered realities are different. So I want to say that both of these señoras were written about or seen as threatening due to their gender, like, realities, like, due to, like, oh, these are, like, some women, like, spouting off some stuff, or, like, the women are joining communism, or things like that, and their gendered interactions, so, like, their husbands, right, the people that they were with were seen as an extension of themselves, or rather, they were seen as an extension of these men, right, so that's a way in which their gender was shaping their reality and their kind of ways that they were surveilled. I think these are moments in their archive or in their history where a señora's gendered and gendered relationships are threatening, but they're also tools to dismiss them as viable players. So, you know, it's like a double-edged sword. How do y'all see señorahood being a threat to oppressive government? And how is it used to dismiss señoras? And is this dismissal actually useful?
Yeah, I think that On the one hand, it makes señoras have to fight harder for recognition of themselves as actual political figures and having a role in the formation of politics and political consciousness. So you see it in their letters, right? In the kind of like correspondence that they have with other people, with politicians. They're very assertive and they're very direct in their communications. You know, we can think of Alicia Hasta la Victoria. We can think of the kinds of archival practices that Francisca had in terms of documenting everything, keeping track of all of the letters, all of the agendas, all of the minutes, and all of the things that they have been able to accomplish under her direction, right? At the same time, yes, they're getting dismissed often and constantly in, I think, a useful way, right? As we said, they're underestimated, they're undermined. It makes them have to fight harder, but at the same time, they can get a lot of things accomplished by like flying under the radar, kind of.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I really like this question because it's so contradictory. It's like kind of hypocritical at the same time. And it kind of is at the crux of a lot of what we're talking about. Like, it makes me think of like the Mexican-American experience as being contradictory. Being a woman feels contradictory. And so I 100% agree that these señoras were seen as a threat, not only to the FBI, but I'd like to throw in here the Communist Party themselves and the Chicano movement. Like, these were also sort of like structural organizations that did the exact same thing. Like, I'm thinking of Francisca's, it noted in her FBI file that she was really, really critical to increasing the amount or the number of Mexican-American communists in LA. She was fundamental to that. She was translating literature and forms and pamphlets. And yet she never held a position of power. She was never elected to anything more than committee members on different kinds of committees, mostly centering Mexican-American neighborhoods. And she was both like incredibly fundamental and useful and then dismissed. And then I think when it comes to the FBI, how señoras are seen as a threat is, I mean, you already said it, Gabby, they're excellent organizers. They were not seen as excellent organizers, but they were. And I think that's part of what we're proving here. And I think that this is why respect is so important to señora power, because the FBI did not have respect for her, thus they could be dismissed. But her community had respect for her, thus she could not be completely, she's still a threat, you know? And so I think that that's why it is like this contradictory position. And I do think it's useful. I do think that being the underdog, I guess, is like a powerful position to be, because you have nothing else to lose. You only have things to gain. And this is like an attitude that I feel like Yolanda really, really has. She was born, in Mexico to immigrant parents, Mexican immigrant parents. And she felt like, I already have, like, I've rolled the dice in life and I'm already like at the bottom. So I'm going to do everything I can and I'm going to stick my neck out there and I'm going to take risks and people aren't going to see me as an incredibly powerful person. And she used that to her benefit to hold influence. I just think it's compelling that you can both be a threat and dismissed at the same time. And it's just, I think, connected to these larger issues where Mexican Americans are caught in between all of these different kind of positionalities.
No, yeah. I mean, I think anytime there's critical mass of people, like, towards a certain ideology, it is threatening in a way to whatever is opposite that or opposing that in a way. I think it's like more legible to me when I think only of gender dynamics within the Chicano movement, for example, which we were, you know, that Sonia brought up and we were talking about that idea of like, yes, señoras are threatening and that's why they're dismissed, right? Because it's like, in a way, I think because it's more legible to me within the Chicano movement, some accounts that we've heard have indicated, oh, like if this señora or this woman actually like wanted to, she could have supplanted certain men in leadership. But that was a threat to them. So then they had to create a rhetoric around this, like, you know, this woman is crazy, or like she's trying to take over, or like she's too preoccupied with her domestic work to like focus on what it really means to be Chicano, you know, things like that, where you get that rhetoric of like feminism is dividing the movement, and painting Chicanas as all white feminists, which was not the case, right? So it's like a misinterpretation in bad faith of like their movement. So I think that's where it becomes more legible to me, where it's like, oh, Señora power is threatening, and therefore that is why they create like rhetorics to dismiss. And I think in the FBI or the surveillance part of it, you know, there is this like double-edged sword, or like this tension with being marginalized, where it's like, oh, like you'll never amount to anything unless there's a lot of you, then there's a problem.
Yeah. I just wanted to pull on that thread of the Chicano movement a little more. Like, we know that, to add to what you're already saying, Chicanas were critiqued by Chicanos for being too white or too aligned with feminism, too aligned with whiteness. And a part of that critique is that these women were going outside of Mexican-American neighborhoods and not having babies with Mexican-American men, thus like creating and continuing the idea of La Raza. Both of our señoras married white men. And I think that alone, we don't have to get into like interracial like history or anything, but I think that alone is a threat to the dominant Chicano traditionalist kind of ideology. Simultaneously, I think it's also really compelling to think about how women who are of a reproductive age offer that kind of idea of babies and family to the Chicano movement. But when women reach a certain age where they no longer either want to have babies or are able to have babies, or reproduction is no longer a part of how society conceives them and their fit within our community, I think that women who are not interested in having babies or cannot have babies anymore are also a threat to society. And so when we talk about señoras, in a way, we're also talking about the women who are mothering, but not in a way that the Chicano movement might want them to be, right? But I just think it's compelling to think about reproduction and señorahood when señorahood no longer really encapsulates a traditional idea of reproduction. And then it becomes dangerous.
Sonia's answer just made me think about what being a threat means, right? Because sure, as a señora, you're not going to be threatening the U.S. government, right? Or the FBI as an institution or anything like that. But you can stir up your local communities, the people close to you, to kind of have a different consideration for what power is, right? Because whenever we think about power, we think about government, we think about like these big things that hold a lot of power. But Señora strategies and their dismissal, right, helps us like shift that around. The power itself is creating a threatening community.
And also, yeah, I mean, I want to like kind of honor what you said about motherhood, Sonia, because it's also another really complex thing in that, you know, you see mothers of East LA, right, here in Los Angeles. And then you also see Las Madres de Guadalupe in Magnolia Park, Houston. And they both, we encountered them both as protesting entities in the archive, like, they were immortalized in the archive because of their protests, because of like their manifestations of anger. I don't know if we've talked about this before, like the idea of like ugly feelings, which is like a scholarly concept, but basically the concept that like this manifestation of emotions that are considered disorderly, like when a marginalized group presents it, it becomes in a way threatening. And I think that's like an interesting thing to look at, that like these mothers who are manifesting their displeasure like publicly were also kind of threatening, and then at the same time were allowed more leeway in a way because they titled themselves mothers. So it's like, again, this like positionality of having a place within a patriarchal system, right? You're a mother, but at the same time, you're stepping outside of the expected role for yourself. So you are not only in relation to your child, but you are out on the streets having a public life, having an opinion in political action. But I think that the concept, like the intersection of señorahood, motherhood, like activism, somehow is extremely threatening. And yet, like, you cannot dismiss it completely, like as a patriarchal society, as a white supremacist society, because a lot of your basic tenets rest upon the concept of motherhood being non-threatening. So if you publicly acknowledge this as being threatening, then what are you saying about your whole entire ideology, right?
Well, I'm thinking of the other meaning of like reproduction, right? The continuation of something, not necessarily in biological terms, in terms of motherhood and stuff like that, but rather in political terms, because, you know, both of our señoras were very much involved in writing, in the reproduction of ideas, specifically like communist ideas, specifically socialist ideas and things like that. Yolanda had a bookstore, right? A self-described communist bookstore. So there's that kind of nourishment of the reproduction of political ideology in this way that centers the community rather than like the broader structures of oppression, et cetera, et cetera. It centers equality. I don't know.
No, it's true. It's kind of where I was thinking too when it comes to women who are post-menstruation, is they're reproducing still, but it's not babies, right? They're like holders of knowledge, of survival strategies, of these things that are fundamental to who we are, maybe as humans, maybe as community members, maybe as political agents. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and I bring this up because it's just such a part of señorahood. And I think that in this, you know, last part of this cycle of like the señoras that we're looking at right now, it's important to look like, you know, what does it mean to be a suspicious señora? And in a way, a lot of our señoras were suspicious too. Like, you know, certain institutional structures. I think about Alicia Escalante too, that she was one of the señoras where her threat was made manifest so clearly, in that, you know, she challenged the Catholic Church in her local area, and she challenged like the governmental structure that had an opinion on single mothers, right? That was negative. And she challenged these two establishments and then got jailed and like felt the consequences of that for the rest of her life, in a way. So I think that, you know, I think it's interesting to see like how consequences fall differently on each señora, and how señorahood is like expressed as a threat and also like dismissed until it can no longer be ignored. So yeah, I think that's interesting too. I think all of this is relevant to our lives today. I do wish that it was not relevant. I do wish we were looking at this in a very archaeological sense, but unfortunately, we are learning every day from these really great señoras. And so bringing us to something else that I think is very pressing today that I kind of touched on before. Now surveillance and suspicion seem to be at an all-time high, right? Or one of the highs in our history in the U.S. And I wonder what we can learn from Señora Yolanda and Señora Francisca about like what moves they were making in the moments that they lived, in the moments that they organized, but despite their struggles with government officials and police, despite multiple arrests in Señora Yolanda's case, these women continued to survive and follow their values that guided them from the beginning. And then when you read their words or you speak to them, you can see their dedication to their communities and greater causes that were kind of guiding them. So these are causes like welfare rights, labor rights, freedom from genocide. And I think that we can really relate to that these days. And I also know that there's a lot of fear in the world right now, which I think sometimes fear can be the antithesis of organizing, of action, of like freedom. And so I wonder, like, what you think the foundation is of these señoras' survival strategies and their convictions. And is being suspicious also a strategy of survival? Or do you think the survival was in spite of being suspicious? I'm trying to parse this out, and I think a lot of people will identify with the idea of having your convictions be very firm in a time that's going to challenge them.
Let me try your first question before I try the second question. Because I do think that fear is a tactic. I think you said fear is the antithesis of organized action, and I think that's very true. And I think what these señoras are doing is that they're not, we might call them fearless, but I would say in reality, they did not live without fear. The fear that we feel in speaking up and being surveilled and living day to day, they felt that fear too. The difference, and I think the foundation of their strategies, is that they took that fear and they shifted it so that it really was more about a fear that what is already happening will only continue to happen and worsen. It's kind of like, I don't know if y'all share this, but I have a fear of being a bystander, or like the bystander effect, like this idea that something really terrible is happening in front of you and you become a bystander because everybody else is standing by and watching, and then that is what continues and perpetuates. So the violence happens and continues happening because people are not stepping up to stop it. And I have my own personal fear that that could be me one day, right? Like that I could see something violent happening and not do anything about it. And so I think that these señoras felt fear and transformed it into fear for others, or fear that the violence will continue, fear that if they don't do something, nobody will. And I think that is a strategy that's compelling and that we're seeing actively, like, used by protesters today. So that's one answer. I think that whether suspicion was a strategy they actively used, or if they were just surviving and then became suspicious because of that, is a really compelling question that I feels a bit like the chicken and the egg situation. But I think because both of these señoras signed up to be active participants in the Communist Party, that they were kind of like, well, I mean, they had to have known that suspicion would be placed on their name should they be doing this. And so it seems like, I don't know, but did they make that decision and then they were just like, yeah, sure, I'll be suspicious because I'm a communist? Or were they like, I don't have an answer, I think. But I do think that they navigated suspicion very well. Like, I'm thinking about Señora Flores and how at the tail end of her Communist Party affiliation, she was already well into the Chicano movement. And the Chicanos were suspect that she was communist, but they didn't know. They didn't have that evidence. And it's incredible to me that she could navigate two political and intense spheres and not have one know about the other. So that tells me that potentially she was able to take suspicion and kind of utilize it to navigate both of those worlds. I don't know. I feel like I rambled at the end, but...
No, I think it's good to rumble because this is, it's a big question, right? It is like a chicken and egg kind of question. And I think the answer is going to be different for all of our señoras, for each of us specifically, for everyone in the world who is kind of like bearing witness to what is going on and how you figure out how to navigate that. So I think what I'm thinking of is that being suspicious is not only a strategy, but it's kind of like a foundational base for señoras to understand their own role in community building and political participation and activism, etc. Like the suspicion is not like I see them being suspect of all of the systems that are going on around them, and we can name them a whole bunch of like different ways, right? Political parties, the patriarchy, the Chicano movement, the lack of welfare and labor and reproductive rights, and all of these overarching kind of like issues that affect them in their own personal life. And the suspicion is kind of saying, well, I don't know if I individually am going to make a difference. I don't know if I can handle these bigger things that are beyond me. But I don't have to be suspicious of my community, the people around me, the people you know are with you sharing these political ideas. I think, yeah, both of our señoras were very suspicious about, you know, the broader organizations around them, the people within them, and you have to be. But again, I think that that suspicion is always there, and it influences what the foundation for them is, right? Is I'm losing my train of thought now. The foundation being like human rights and being able to like survive within these, within and despite the violence that surrounds you, right? You're suspicious of the violence. You're suspicious that this is the way that it should be.
Yeah, I think because I think there's also like that suspicion both ways kind of thing. And I've known people who have been like, oh, well, like as long as the government's suspicious of me, I'm like doing my job. Like I've heard that before. I don't know, you know, obviously everyone has a different like take on that idea, but looking at the history of these women, I think that there is some of that too, where it's like, well, if you're living in a country where you disagree with the government's way of being, then if they're like suspicious of you, that might be mean that you're doing something right. But then on the other side, Sophia, as you were saying, like there's also the suspicion from like the señoras or the community towards outsiders. And I think that's something like, you know, that's understandable. And I think that a lot of señoras have occupied the role of like verifier, background checker on behalf of their communities based on like the healthy suspicion of like, are you going to come into our community and do something good? Or are you gonna come into our community and betray us? And because they have the connections to be able to do these kinds of background checks in a way, I think that's also a señora power. And I think, you know, especially with these two women, Yolanda and Francisca, who were engaged in political activities. And I think that's the other part. A lot of señoras have done really important activism, have gained rights for the communities, and have flown under the radar because they were organizing around things that were quote unquote like domestic or something. And I think that these señoras too like gained government attention because they were politically conscious and they were expressing their political consciousness like on a public stage. And so that like public versus private kind of like dichotomy, as in like private being the home and public being like the streets or something, you can also see here that they were such a threat because they were manifesting their political opinion like on a public forum. So yeah, I guess just to say like suspicious both ways. Like you are being suspected and also you're suspecting others. And I think, yeah, like, you know, there is I think a strategy there, but there's also just like the fact of it happening to you.
Well, and just like a very quick example from our present moment, because I know that in our conversations we often just try to like talk about the señoras and about their situation and stuff like that. But we see it now, you know, with the whole issue of with the immigration landscape and the whole issue of like mass deportations and stuff like that. And a particular thing I'm thinking about is, you know, a lot of people have taken to posting like, hey, I see Border Patrol or I see ICE at this intersection, at this street, at this address or whatever. And people at the beginning were kind of like reacting positively to that, right? Like, oh, thanks for letting us know. Eventually, people started to get suspicious of it. Like, hey, how do we know that you're not one of those informers that we know about in previous like historical periods? We talked about COINTELPRO. We talked about like how spies would kind of like infiltrate these movements and you know report back to the FBI and things like that. So that suspicion is still very much a part of community organizing, especially nowadays. And now it's like, hey, if you want to like give this warning, you better take a picture of it, include a timestamp. And the suspicion is also, as Sonia was saying earlier about the bystander effect, right? You have to be suspicious that this might at some point happen to you. And that leads to preparation, to preparedness, to knowing what to do, to knowing your rights.
The only other thing I wanted to add that I actually thought of when you were talking, Sophia, you made me think of how suspicion, to be suspicious and to be suspicious of, is like a distrust. And Gabby, you were kind of talking about this when you were talking about like distrusting, making sure to vet people before you bring them into your inner community. And I think that it connects to how we've been talking about power, because a lot of our señoras have been uncomfortable with that idea of power. The word itself seems almost violent or arrogant or something negative to them. And I think that that has some suspicion to it. I think they're suspicious of power. And I think that that makes for the best quote-unquote leaders. I'm always suspicious of people who crave power or who really, really want to be in positions of power, because it feels like they're uncritical of what it means to hold that kind of influence, to make decisions for those kinds of people. And so I think our señoras use that distrust of power as a strategy to not only hold it themselves, but to interact with people that hold it.
Yeah, and I kind of wanted to come back around, because I think like it's such a hard thing to organize in like a fraught environment where it feels like your community is at war with people who like live around you, right? So I do want to caveat also the suspicion. And I think we've like explained it, right? There's a context for the suspicion. But I think that's why it's so important to know the people that you're organizing. And also, I think I've mentioned this before on this podcast, but like, do you know your neighbors' like names, right? Like, that's it's important too. And like knowing people who like you're asking things of, and like being able to ask things of each other. Like, you know, in union organizing, people often are tempted to say, oh, the union does this, the union does that. But it's like the answer is like, you know, you are the union. And I think that that's kind of the part of señorahood that I also really admire, want to emulate, the fact that like, it's like, are you mad about something? You can change that too. And by the same token, you can know who's around you. You can convince them to help you change things. And that's the best, deepest organizing. And I know that, like, you know, we have to understand that people go to protests with their faces covered because not everyone has the same privilege. Also, it's really important to know who's behind that face covering if you are also protesting next to them. And I think that's kind of the double-edged sword of suspicion, where it's like, you want to make sure to keep people protected who are vulnerable. And in the past in this country, people have infiltrated movements. Also, you don't want to let suspicion get in the way of like majority action. Because I think that's the thing, is like some people talk about like, oh, those people are lost causes. But I think talking to Yolanda, like she lives around people she may or may not agree with, as we all do. And she sees them as part of her community. And that's how we win, right? Is like, okay, this person doesn't agree with me, and yet they're still part of my community. And so how can we both work together to win? And I think that's like the most important thing right now, is to understand suspicion in a context and use it appropriately as a strategy, rather than having it be a divisive thing that will in fact empower whatever oppressive entity you're trying to fight against, right?
I think that's a great way to put it. Like, be suspicious of when people tell you that this is the way that things are and this is the way that things are going to continue to be. Don't be suspicious about the people around you. Get to know the people around you.
Totally. Thanks for joining us for the conversation about Señora Yolanda and Señora Francisca. As we saw, it's not just a conversation about them. It's a conversation about where we are now as a community, as an extended society. And also, you know, hopefully this helps you think about who you want to be in this moment and how you can achieve that. Talk to your neighbor this week and learn their names if you don't know already. If you do, maybe take them a little baked good, a little pastry. So that is Señora Power wrapped up for you. And we'll see you next time. Bye.